Okay, this is our third class in medieval church history. We're actually going to go a little bit further than the year 1000. And the big issue for us in this period is the relationship of the church to the state, the relationship of pope to emperor, if you will. And on your outline, there are three theories as to how these two entities work together. And the first theory is that the pope and the emperor are each independently commissioned by God to rule within their own spheres, the sacred and the secular. They are coordinate. Neither is above the other. This is the ideal, and in practice, I doubt if it ever really happened. If you were here last week, you may remember I showed you a picture from the Middle Ages of Peter conferring upon the pope and upon Charlemagne in their respective spheres, his authority. And you remember in that picture, they were both of equal height. Well, that's the first theory. Again, that's the ideal. I don't think it ever happened. The second theory is that the emperor is superior to the pope in secular affairs. And as substantiating this, the fact that Jesus paid tribute and that he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And then there historically were the donations that Pepin and Charlemagne made to the pope, which had the effect of making the pope a vassal, beholden to the emperor, to the king, the political leader. And that's the second theory. And the third one, of course, is the opposite, that the temporal authority, the emperor, is subordinate to the spiritual, to the pope. Even in secular affairs, the soul rules over the body, the spiritual over the physical. The sun is superior to the moon. And the scriptural reference here to Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 10, this is where God says to Jeremiah, I have set you over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. Now, Jeremiah, acting as the prophet of the Lord, was pronouncing God's judgment on various kingdoms and nations at that time. But as the representative of God, that's how the pope would see himself. And then 1 Corinthians 2:15, the spiritual man judges all things, but is himself judged by no one. Well, as I said, this is the big story in this particular period of church history. In the area that we're talking about today, there were two big things that were going on, and I don't think we're going to be able to actually get to the Crusades today. We'll get just about right up to the Crusades, but we're moving to that point where we're going to see the spiritual authority as represented by the pope, and the pope is the Bishop of Rome, okay, flexing his muscles in such a way as to exercise authority not just over churches, but over the temporal or secular realm as well. That's the big issue. And Roman numeral 2, the investiture controversy. If I were going to invest David here with authority as a bishop, I would have to be superior to him. So the question in the investiture controversy was, who really does invest with authority? Is it the emperor? Is it the pope? Now, I've got to back up a little bit because in the first hour earlier today, I think there was some confusion on terminology. When I'm using the term emperor, I'm talking about the political leader in the western part of the church. Okay, this would be Italy, Northern Europe. And you will remember from last week what developed was these two dynasties of Frankish kings, the Merovingian dynasty, and as that became decrepit, it was replaced by the Carolingian dynasty. And the big dog king there was Charlemagne. Remember Charlemagne? He was the big guy. And he was not referred to as emperor at this time, but there was such a strong desire to revive the glories that were Rome that following Charlemagne, some of his descendants, in particular a guy named Otto, revived what he called the Holy Roman Empire, which, as it has been said, was neither holy nor was it Roman, and neither was it an empire. Nevertheless, that's what it was. That's what he called it. He was the king over a large area of France, Germany, that area. And this revival of the empire, of course, enabled him to call himself an emperor, right? Okay. So when we're in this period now in church history, the 900s, the 1000s AD, emperor refers to that big king of the Charlemagne type in Northern Europe. The Pope is the Bishop of Rome. Every church had a bishop, a monarchical bishop at this point. The Bishop of Rome was referred to as the Pope. And we're talking about the western part of Christendom right now. So it's the interaction between the Pope and the Emperor. And who has the authority, who has the right, who has the power to invest a local bishop with these two temporal things, the episcopal ring, the ring of the bishop, and the pastoral staff? These were the two physical objects that were actually given to a bishop at a time of his investiture. The episcopal ring symbolized his mystical marriage to the church. And of course, the staff was the symbol of his role as a shepherd by which he exercised care and authority. All right? Who gets to do that? Nicholas I, back in the mid-800s, was one of the strongest representatives and promoters of the papacy. And he made full use of those false decretals. Do you remember last week we talked about the false decretals, the pseudo-Isidorian decretals? These were forged documents. And this is how it went. This is by way of reminder. According to the legend, because it just really was a false tale, really, Constantine the Great, back in the 4th century, had leprosy. And he went to the Bishop of Rome at the time, Sylvester, who prayed for him, and he was healed of his leprosy. And out of gratitude to Sylvester for healing him, Constantine the Great conferred upon Sylvester the spiritual authority over all the churches, both Western and Eastern, and temporal authority in the West. Now, this was clearly false, but these documents were forged and were pawned off as authentic, and the popes at this time made full use of this and said, "See, according to the great Constantine, we have this authority." And so Nicholas used this authority, and he flexed his muscles and threw his weight around with regard to telling the emperor in the north, King Lothair, what he could and couldn't do with regard to divorcing his wife. He also tried to assert himself over the churches in the east without much success. As time goes on, in the next couple of centuries, this flexing of the muscles of the Bishop of Rome continued, and that's what gave rise to the investiture controversy. Now, I mentioned about Germany and Otto the Great. His years were 963 to 973, who attempted to restore the Holy Roman Empire. Let me just fast forward a little bit, a few centuries to the time of the Reformation. The Holy Roman Empire is still in existence, and the Holy Roman Emperor at that time is Charles V of Spain. He was the King of Spain, the King of Belgium, and probably some other little duchies as well. But the Holy Roman Empire wasn't really necessarily the king over everything. I've been told that it's best to think of him kind of like the chairman of the board of a number of European states. And he was, at that time, elected. There were five electors that would elect from among the various candidates, different kings there in Europe, who should be the Holy Roman Emperor. And one of the electors was Frederick of Saxony, who was Luther's prince. So that's what developed. But back at this time, they're still trying to feel their way into, we want this empire. And so Otto is putting himself forth in this way. And France, Burgundy, and Italy were still broken up into many feudal states. Otto's attempts to consolidate these German duchies, a duke would rule over a duchy. His attempt to consolidate them was partially successful, and he found help from the church. He would donate large estates to the church and elevate bishops to feudal lord status. Maybe I should just mention a little bit about feudalism. You've probably heard of feudalism. Feudalism was the economic system that was in place at the time. And in feudalism, you had the lord of a manor, and you had his subjects. The lord of a manor could be a knight, somebody who would protect the people in his manor. And the serfs and the other people, they would serve, they would till the land and whatnot, and they would pledge their loyalty, their fealty, their allegiance to their knight or their noble or their prince. And it could ascend up the order all the way up to the big king. One of the reasons that these feudal states had to organize in this way for protection was that over the centuries, men from the north, Northmen, Norsemen, came to be called in one part of France Norman, Normandy, and then jumped across the channel in 1066 at the Battle of Hastings, William the Conqueror, and that incursion into England. But these Norsemen, these Vikings, with their shallow draft vessels, were able to race up the water courses. So if you lived anywhere along a river in England or even Ireland, the European continent, you could come up the rivers, come up the creeks, the streams and whatnot, and they were rough. I mean, they just, for centuries this went on. And the destruction and that they caused led these small groupings of people to, we're going to have to, you know, build stockades. We're going to have to build walled encampments. The development of castles with castle keeps people could run into. And we need help. We need protection. And so this is part of the impetus for the development of these feudal estates. Well, okay, you got an estate. And then there would be a bishop over that manor that would act for the church in that area or for a monastery. Well, Otto donated large estates to the church, and he elevated bishops to feudal lordship status. He would actually prefer to have a bishop in that role because a bishop was not allowed to marry and couldn't produce heirs. So when that bishop died, the land would revert back to the bigger king in that area, of whom that was Otto, let's assume. And then he could appoint somebody else. And the reason it was a lucrative thing was because these were, you know, valuable to have this land, to be a landholder, to be a bishop that was a landholder. And because it was valuable, I'll invest you to do this, David, but it's going to cost something. The paying of fees for a benefice like this became known by the word simony. And simony gets its name from Acts chapter 8, where Simon the sorcerer tried to buy from Peter and John the ability to confer the gift of the Holy Spirit. And you will remember that Peter sharply rebuked him. So simony has always had a bad name. Nevertheless, this is the sort of thing that went on. It's not that you're actually buying this from me. You're making a donation to me. And at the very same time, what do you know, that you're making this donation, I'm actually going to give you something. It reminds me of some things I've heard on the radio at times. For a donation of $30, I will send you my cassette series on how to prosper. But it sounds like they're buying it from... Oh, no, no, it's not. It's a donation. We're very clear about it. It's a donation. Well, I think if we're really clear about it, we have to say it's a racket, because that's what it is. Well, these appointments, these investitures, were made to the highest bidder. And the practice of buying the spiritual, simony, just became rampant. It was a cause of great corruption. All right, and this is what Otto was doing. Now, somebody looked at this and said, I don't like that the secular ruler is making these appointments. I should be making these appointments because I am the spiritual ruler over all of the churches in the West. And I actually have some temporal clout too, according to the decretals. And so this is what the Pope was saying. He wanted to make these appointments. And so at the Lateran Council of 1075, Gregory the VII forbade any cleric to receive a bishopric or an abbey from the hand of any secular ruler. In other words, he banned lay investiture. Only the Pope may invest with this kind of spiritual authority. Now, his name was Gregory the VII, also known as Hildebrand. His years were 1073 to 1085. And he's number three on your outline there. And I have to digress a little bit to say, now, where did he come from? And what's the background here? And if we look back a little ways in history, there was a very significant thing that took place where Duke William of Aquitaine, which is in southeastern France, made a gift of the town and the manor of Cluny for the erection of a Benedictine monastery. This was a century or century and a half before. The Benedictines were the ones that really were in charge of monasteries at this time. They, ever since the 6th century, the rule of Saint Benedict, that was what kind of held sway. And the Benedictine monasteries required manual labor for the support of the ministry. But this was going to be different. Because the gift of Duke William included tillers of the soil, labor by monks was not necessary. The monks were to spend all of their time in intercessory prayer, in the transmission of learning, and also in hospitality. And from this time, monasteries begin in an increasing way to be the inns of the Middle Ages as a specific role. To provide safety for travelers. Anyway, this program of Cluny differed, according to Bainton, I'm quoting here, the program of Cluny differed from that of other Benedictine monasteries because it envisaged a Christian reordering of the whole fabric of society, monastic, civil, even ecclesiastical. The role of the monastery in the world was no longer directed toward conversions, which were often nominal, but to the permeation of society by Christian ideals. Whereas Benedict had sought to segregate his monks from society, the Cluniacs tried to integrate monasticism and society. In other words, they wanted to influence the culture. Now, Hildebrand, Gregory the VII, a very significant pope at this time, came out of the Cluniac monastery system, as did his predecessor, Leo the IX. Leo was a very energetic, a very active and enterprising pope. He, like the other Cluniacs, desired to reform the papacy. Papacy had fallen into great corruption at this time. And they wanted to bring back the ideals of celibacy. They wanted to get rid of simony. He expanded, Leo did, the College of Cardinals at this time. And his conception was that, and I'm quoting here, the Roman Church was founded by God alone. The Roman Pope alone can with right be called universal. He alone may use the imperial insignia. His feet only shall be kissed by all princes. He may depose emperors. He himself may be judged by no man. The Roman Church has never erred, nor will it err in all eternity. These were you know, great claims. But this was the way that Leo looked at it, and Hildebrand, in following with him, also saw things in this way. Now, in the investiture controversy, Gregory wanted to raise church standards, but he was very concerned about lay investiture and his prerogatives as pope. And so what developed was one of the most dramatic events in the history of the church, and I thought I'd just take this opportunity to read to you a little bit from Schaff, an anecdote of the times that I think really kind of sums up what was going on. There was this dispute between Henry IV, who was the emperor in the north, and Hildebrand, Gregory VII, who was pope at that time. They had this conflict, and Henry had been investing bishops with their episcopal authority in the north. Hildebrand, Pope Gregory, took the initiative of banning lay investiture and said anybody that gets his authority from a secular prince doesn't have any authority at all. So Henry took the initiative of calling together a council in the north, and he said some things, some very unkind things about Gregory. By the way, Gregory had come to his papal office in a kind of an irregular manner. He wasn't exactly elected by due process. And so, seizing on that and some other things that they didn't like, Henry and his bishops, in a decree of Worms, wrote to Gregory, informing him of this decree in an insulting letter, and I'm quoting, "Henry, King, not by usurpation, but by God's holy ordinance, to Hildebrand, not Pope, but a false monk, how darest thou, who hast won thy power through craft, flattery, bribery, and force, stretch forth thy hand against the Lord's anointed, me, okay, despising the precept of the true Pope, St. Peter, who said, fear God and honor the King," and Peter did write that, "thou who dost not fear God, dishonorest thou me whom he has appointed? Condemned by the voice of all our bishops, quit the apostolic chair, and let another take it who will preach the sound doctrine of St. Peter and not do violence under the cloak of religion. I, Henry, by the grace of God, King, with all my bishops, say unto thee, come down, come down." That was the famous descende, descende. Come down from that papal chair, you imposter, you. All right, well, those are fighting words, aren't they? Henry sent a representative to council at Rome, and who brought this letter, and this very brave priest, a guy named Roland, came down and brought the letter, and he also said these words to 110 bishops that were there: "I tell you, brethren, that you must appear at Pentecost before the king to receive from his hands a pope and a father. For this man is not a pope, but a ravening wolf." And according to Schaff, this produced a storm of indignation. The bishops drew swords and were ready to kill him on the spot, but Gregory remained calm and protected him against violence. But on the next day, the pope excommunicated and deposed Henry in the name of St. Peter and absolved his subjects from their oath of obedience. This would, I believe, also involve the placing of Henry's lands under the interdict. Now that ban or that interdict meant that the sacrament of the host, the Mass, could not be offered to the people that came under Henry's authority. So that if they were to die without receiving that sacrament, they would go to hell. It was be a mortal sin. This is a really big deal. This causes public opinion and a popular uprising against Henry. Now, both these guys have authority, and both of them are involved in somewhat of a public relations campaign to get supporters behind them. And Henry certainly had the support of his bishops. He, after all, had invested them with authority. But there were other German nobles that were not so sure. And they began to question whether Henry really could make good in his position. And after a while, they encouraged him, "You better go and get right with the Pope, because we don't think this is going in the right direction." So the Pope excommunicated Henry, and at the same time, he excommunicated all the German and Italian bishops who had despised him and deposed him. And this called into question, you know, the whole system up there. So anyway, what happened next is very interesting. Henry decides to go and seek absolution from the Pope. In other words, he's going to go as a penitent, and he's going to seek the forgiveness of the Pope whom he has insulted. This is the famous Canossa episode. And again, I'm reading from Schaff. It says, "The winter of 1076-77 was one of the coldest and longest within the memory of men, the Rhine being frozen to a solid mass from November till April. And it was one of the most memorable in history, being marked by an event of great significance, the humiliation of the head of the German Empire at the feet of the Bishop of Rome at Canossa, meant the subjection of the state to the church and the triumph of the Hildebrandian policy. A few days before Christmas, Henry IV left Spires in Germany on a journey across the Alps as a penitent seeking absolution from the Pope. He was accompanied by his wife with her infant son and a faithful servant." He continues on. The Pope at this time actually had been traveling north to address a council in Worms, and he turned aside because of the weather and for safety to a castle at Canossa high in the Italian Alps. It was owned by someone who was in support of him. Canossa, now in ruins, was an impregnable it's now in ruins, but it was at that time an impregnable fortress of the Countess Matilda. The Pope had already received a number of excommunicated bishops and noblemen, and had given or promised them absolution after the case of the chief sinner against the Majesty, namely Henry IV. Henry arrived at the foot of the castle steep January 21, 1077, when the cold was severe and the ground covered with snow. He had an interview with Matilda and Hugo, abbot of Cluny, his godfather, and declared to them his willingness to submit to the Pope if he were released from the interdict. But Gregory would only absolve him on condition that he would surrender to him his crown and forever resign the royal dignity. The king made the last step to secure the mercy of the Pope. He assumed the severest penances which the church requires from a sinner as a sure way to absolution. So for 3 days, from the 25th to the 28th of January, he stood in the court between the inner walls as a penitent suppliant with bare feet and bare head in a coarse woolen shirt, standing in the snow, shivering in the cold, knocking in vain for entrance at the gateway, which still perpetuates in its name Porta di Penitenza, in memory of this event. The stern old Pope, hard as a rock and cold as the snow, you get a little bit of Schaff's verbiage here. The stern old Pope, hard as a rock and cold as the snow, refused admittance, notwithstanding the earnest entreaties of Matilda and Hugo, until he was satisfied that the cup of humiliation had been drained to the dregs, or that further resistance would be impolitic. He first exacted from Henry, as a condition of absolution, the promise to submit to his decision at the approaching meeting of the German nobles under the presidency of the Pope as arbiter, and to grant him and his deputies protection on their journey to the north. In the meantime, he was to abstain from exercising the functions of royalty. The king made the promise, and two bishops and several nobles in his behalf swore upon sacred relics that he would keep it. Hugo, being a monk, could not swear, but pledged his word before the all-seeing God. And after these preliminaries, the inner gate was opened. The king, in the prime of life, an heir of many crowned monarchs, and a man of tall and noble presence, threw himself at the feet of the gray-haired Pope, a man of low origin and of small and unimpressive stature, who by his word had disarmed an empire. He burst into tears and cried, "Spare me, Holy Father, spare me." The company were moved. Even the Iron Pope showed signs of tender compassion. He heard the confession of Henry, raised him up, gave him absolution and his apostolic blessing, conducted him to the chapel, and sealed the reconciliation by the celebration of the sacrifice of the Mass. Some chroniclers add the following incident, which has often been repeated but is very improbable. Gregory, before partaking of the sacrament, called upon God to strike him dead if he were guilty of the crimes charged on him, and after eating one half of the consecrated wafer unharmed, he offered the other half to Henry, requesting him to submit to the same awful ordeal, but the king declined it and referred the whole question to the decision of a general council. Well, I prefer to say that they all lived happily ever after. However, that wouldn't be true. As it happened, once he had been absolved, eventually Henry regained his royal status, and when he got the upper hand politically, the Pope suffered as a result, had to flee from Rome, died in exile. So, who won this battle? Well, in a certain sense, they both did. However, I think we would have to say that following these events, papal stock went up and their authority increased until you get to the point where the Pope is going to be raising armies, declaring holy war, and marching on the Holy Land. And the papacy is going to rise to dizzying heights before it eventually has quite a fall. So that's the investiture controversy, and now I'd like to take just a few moments to talk about the schism of 1054. This schism or schism, by the way, I understand that in England they say schism and in America they say schism, so you're okay, whatever you want to say. Of 1054 had its roots long before that. And we're talking about the Eastern Church and the Western Church, what we know today as the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church. There were differences in language, Greek spoken in the East, Latin in the West. Differences in culture. Differences in national character, especially differences in ecclesiastical organization, in liturgy, in theology. But these were more differences of emphasis, not differences in terms of contradicting theology. The center of gravity with regard to missionary activity had been moving west ever since the time of Pentecost. That's not to say there wasn't some missionary activity that went eastward. According to a strong tradition, Thomas brought the gospel to India, and there are still churches in India that would claim that their roots were with the Apostle Thomas. But for the most part, in the New Testament, you see things moving west. You remember that strategic point, was it Acts 16, Acts 17, where Paul is in western, what is today Turkey, and it says he essayed to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit would not let him. Then he tried to go in another direction, and again, he was resisted by the Holy Spirit, and then he goes to bed and he has a dream, and a man says in the night, "Come over into Macedonia and help us." And language is very interesting. Apparently, they didn't even wait for sunrise. But Paul gets up and the apostolic band begins to cross over into Macedonia, going from Asia into Europe. And the gospel tends to move in that direction. Well, that was going on. In terms of missionary activity, all the activity seems to be in the West now. So that's a difference that's going on. Things seem to stagnate a bit in the East. Although in the East, you begin to see the gospel move, we can call it the gospel, but, you know, Byzantine Christianity move into Bulgaria, Montenegro, Serbia, and then up into Russia, where eventually Moscow will regard itself as the third most important city in Christendom after Rome and Constantinople, Moscow. There was ecclesiastical separation between East and West ever since Constantine moved the seat of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, present-day Istanbul. The church in the East was under the jurisdiction of an emperor. Church in the West, not so anymore. Wasn't any emperor. And Rome's bishop was too far away to be controlled. Earl Cairns has written that emperors in the East were almost popes, and popes in the West were almost emperors. There was also a difference that the two wings of the church had in their intellectual outlook. The East was much more philosophically oriented, whereas the West was much more pragmatic. All of the great doctrinal formulations took place at councils in the East. There was some Western representation, but the Council of Nicaea, the Councils of Constantinople, the Council of Chalcedon, all these take place in the East. And the creeds, like the Nicene-Constantinopolitan Creed, the Chalcedonian Creed, this all takes place again in the East. It's not happening in the West. In the East, the clergy were allowed to marry, but they weren't in the West. Albert Newman, a Baptist historian from a century ago, said that nothing better illustrates the differences between East and West than their brands of monasticism. Oriental monasticism was intensely ascetic, contemplative, and speculative. In the West, most of the missionary zeal came from the monks. Whenever an emergency has arisen that the existing orders seemed unable to meet, new orders have sprung into the existence, have sprung into existence. And this, I think, represents some of the genius of the Roman Catholic Church. When you have, for instance, a Francis that rises up and says, this church has become so worldly and, you know, it's corrupted. Instead of saying, get out of here, they say, well, you know, please, there are many that feel like you. Start an order. And, you know, Rome wraps its, Mother Rome wraps its large arms around and enfolds it instead of getting rid of it. And so you have the development of different orders of monks and nuns that champion various needs and causes within the Roman Catholic Church. They just get embraced. It's interesting because when new needs come up in the Roman Catholic Church, it seems like a new order would form. The Evangelical Church forms parachurch ministries that do kind of similar things. And oftentimes, same kinds of confusions can result. There was another issue that separated East from West, the iconoclast controversy. This is a rather complicated thing, and I won't try to get too much into it, but the East developed this form of artistic instruction and spirituality that often goes under the name of iconography. If you've ever been in an Eastern Orthodox church, you'll notice some of the beautiful artwork. These are not statues, but icons are a very specific form of artwork. They are made in relief, and the image can protrude, I think, maybe, I don't know if it's 1 or 2 inches away from the flat surface, but no more than that. And all of the images, all of the saints, are never presented in profile. They're always presented full face, and they're looking at you. And if you've ever looked at it, it's almost like they're looking right through you. It's a very interesting thing. But they're not worshiping these images. They are, however, venerating them. And they would make a very clear distinction here. So we don't have the idolatry of making a graven image. In the West, if you go into many Roman Catholic churches, you'll often see statuary, and some of, again, very, very beautiful. Well, they didn't like that. It's a little bit complicated. It's much more complicated than I'm saying. But there was an iconoclast. By the way, iconoclast means smash the icon. That's what that word means. The idol smashers, and they go into these churches if they saw something they didn't like, smash these idols, kind of like Gideon did back in the days of the Judges. And, you know, cutting down the Asherah pole and, you know, smashing the golden calf and stuff like that. That's how they regarded it. So it was something that captured the the popular mind. There was a controversy over that. There were problems that would come up between the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Bishop of Rome and these little political things. I have a quote from Ferguson that I wanted to read. The Eastern Church drew its self-understanding more from the local assembly united in fellowship, from its sacraments, and from the ecumenical creeds. In contrast, the Western Church was coming to define itself more in terms of canon law and hierarchical submission to a monarchic head, Pope. Okay? So, in the East, the leadership was more diffuse. Even though, yeah, you had a Patriarch of Constantinople, there were five other cities that had patriarchs too. But in the West, there was nobody that rivaled the authority of the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. And so he's consolidating authority, and that's going on at this time. Well, things came to a head in the 11th century. After a period of political decline, the emperor in the East, Constantine Monachimus, needed Rome's help to defend his possessions in Italy. You see, the church in the East, they had some churches and properties in Italy, in the West. And the church of Rome, they had some churches and some property in the East as well. It's like if you had an ambassador over there, if you had, you know. So the emperor in the East needed Rome's help to guard against some of the Norman raiders in the West. And in return, he prepared to recognize Pope Leo's claim to supremacy. But as you can imagine, the patriarch in the East didn't think that was a good idea at all. And that patriarch of Constantinople was Michael Cerularius. He had other plans. He actually wished to become more like the Pope over the Eastern Church and make his church independent of the state. So he took the move in 1053 AD to close the Latin churches and monasteries that were in Constantinople, and he instigated a letter criticizing the Latin or Roman church. The letter had the intended effect of arousing Leo to anger, and a bitter controversy broke out between them. The emperor tried to heal the breach, and he invited the Roman Pope to send legates to Constantinople, and they did. They sent three legates. One of them was a Cardinal Humbert, who was a rather hot-tempered man. When they came over to Constantinople, they had a discussion. Things didn't go well. And then Cerularius, the archbishop or the patriarch of Constantinople, made a move by burning in the presence of the Roman legates the writing that the Pope had sent over. That was a move that was calculated to infuriate and inflame. And so those Roman legates, on behalf of the Pope, excommunicated Michael Cerularius, the patriarch of Constantinople. And he returned the favor by excommunicating those three papal legates. That was the incident that sealed the breach between East and West in what's known as the Schism of 1054. Now, that lasted until December the 7th, 1965. I was 15 years old. I didn't even know what happened. It was probably in the newspaper. But the Pope in Rome got together with the Patriarch of Constantinople, and they said, hey, let's let bygones be bygones. The interesting thing was that the excommunications that were made were not against the different churches, the people, or even the emperor on the one side and the Pope on the other side. It was against those principals who had been involved. They excommunicated one another. Okay? So it didn't really extend to the actual people in the two churches, who I think just regarded themselves as separated brethren of some sort. But that was, what was really going on there? There were some other things. There was a theological difference they had over an addition that the Western Church had made to the Nicene Creed. Where in the Nicene Creed it's stated that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father, the Western Church added what's called the Filioque Clause. said the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Filioque is Latin for "and the Son." The Eastern wing of the church said that that is an innovation that's messing around with the creed, and they strongly disapproved of that language, "and of the Son." So that was a theological reason given, along with the other things I said, given for the split. But as one historian put it, and I can't remember which one it was, but I kind of agree with this, is there had been divisions going on for centuries, and yet they never regarded themselves as requiring division. But what was different at this time was the will to stay united just wasn't there anymore. It's like, what do we have in common with one another? The forms of Christianity are so different.